Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Wednesday, July 30th, 2003. Today's session is entitled The Working Poor, Politics and Public Policy, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
Thank you for coming tonight. It's an excuse to get out of the hot in there and come into the hot in here. But I'm John Marty. I'm a state senator from Minnesota doing a series of talks on public policy. And tonight's topic is on the working poor and poverty in America. And this is one that political circles tend to have very tight debate on certain areas about welfare and other things. And sometimes we lose the big picture in the course of political discourse. And to frame the issue, we talk about how we rate in poverty in the U.S. is not like poverty in other countries. We don't have massive numbers of people going through starvation at any one given time, but there are people who are malnourished in America. One in six Americans is without health insurance now.
I'm one of them.
And in some cases, that does not mean, in the end, if somebody has a heart attack, they go to the hospital by ambulance and they will get some care. So it's not like one in six has no access to care, but it means when a child has an ear infection, you don't take care of the ear infection because you can't afford to go to the doctor and you make it worse. And then when you need to go to the emergency room, then it's covered. But basically, one in six Americans does not have medical care. And from the places where I know the numbers better, Minnesota, about half the people in Minnesota's homeless shelters are working people, or families of working parents. And again, half of them are children. That's something that's unusual because 20, 30, 40 years ago, we had homeless shelters only for those who were mentally ill or chemically dependent, street people, everybody else. You didn't have families where the kids go to school in a day, then they get bused back to the homeless shelter, and where kids are going to five different schools in a school year because their parents are trying to find and can work out temporary housing. And food shelf use is up this year and last year because of the declining economy, but the late boom years of the 90s, food shelf use was significant then, much higher than 10, 15 years ago. And one of the best, and a lot of these people are working people who are going to food shelves to supplement their diet because they don't have enough food at the end of the month. There's a book in the libraries, in the bookstore, that several people here told me they were reading right now, and it's a good one to refer to on this issue. Barbara Ehrenreich, the author, about 2 years ago, she was talking with editor and saying somebody ought to go do a story of working poor. Some young journalist just out of college, no family or anything, ought to do this, and the editor said you'd be good for it. And so she went around three or four different cities in the country, and she took a job as a hotel cleaner, she took a job room cleaner, she took a job at a restaurant, places where she was making $6, $7, $8 an hour, $9 an hour, and then trying to find housing on it. She said you couldn't say she was really poor. She could always fall back on her other wife and so on. But she wrote about her experiences, a powerful book. It's called Nickel and Dime, subtitles.
In America.
Nickel and Dime, Not Getting By in America or something like that. But it's worth looking in the bookstore. And those kind of stories we have happen all the time. I remember a couple of years ago at a hearing on homelessness, a woman coming and testifying about how, yeah, she worked at a restaurant an hour north of Twin Cities, there was a link behind the thing, and all summer long, every day she'd tell her bosses on right off she got work, I'm gonna go for a swim. She didn't tell them it was because that was her bath, because she lived in her car. That happens. We had a 17-year-old girl who was trying to be or supposed to be in school, but she was one of those kids who had been bounced from foster home to foster home since she was two or three, and finally nothing fit right, so she ran away, and she got a job as a retail clerk. She was working over 40 hours a week. But she said, yeah, I could get an apartment, but I wouldn't want to live in the part of town where, the kind of place where, what she could afford on her retail clerk job. Why we have this where people who are working can't afford basic necessities. We used to talk about in the welfare debate in the 70s, used to be the deserving poor, namely the people who, I guess, deserve to be poor, no, deserve help. People who, because of a disability, and again, mental disabilities, you can't always see. So it's easy if you have a physical disability, oh, that poor person who's blind, oh, they can't work. Most people with disabilities can and want to work. You need some accommodations for it. But the deserving poor were ones who were trying to work, not those lazy welfare bums. Lazy welfare bums have pretty much been pushed in most places into the workforce where they're now lazy working welfare bums. And many of them working more than 40 hours a week trying to patch things together, which is hard when you don't have a working or reliable car, hard when you can't, you have no way to pick up your kids after school, no daycare, no other things. And the political debate ignores this significant portion of the American population. And again, probably two times that many or three times that many people are on the verge of it. They lose a few, they get laid off or divorced or something else, and all of a sudden they can't pay for health insurance anymore. And they're stuck. Last year, on Labor Day, I heard a Paul Wellstone speech in which he talked about the need for American political system to get back to the center. And Paul Wellstone talking about the center of politics isn't what most people think of political middle of the roaders, which most politicians seem to claim they hold. He said we got to get back to the center of what's important in people's lives, healthcare and housing and education. Why can't the political system address those issues? And here we don't. We clearly don't. Is this an issue we should be concerned about? Well, I think as many people here come here because of Christian beliefs and value about the importance of caring for our neighbor in need. In our government 7 decades ago in the New Deal, at a time, a grim time when a third of a nation was ill-housed, came together and made a social compact. I don't think they called it that, but the New Deal was a form of a social compact. We spelled out the fact, what we expected out of a person. 40 hours was full-time work. They talked about 44 hours, it ended up being 40 hours was what they agreed to. It was full-time work. That's what you should, as a working person, be expected to put in. And in exchange for that, you're going to get a minimum wage. It's not going to make you rich, but it'll be a minimum that'll put a floor underneath your living standard. You'll have basic necessities. And we'll even make sure we take care of things like retirement, so that you, and disability, other things. So you're gonna put in 40 hours of work, and we're gonna give you this in exchange. And we've never really lived up to that. It took 3-4 decades before medical care for the elderly and poor came in the 60s. Food stamps came in around that time, and things to help people with their basic needs. But we never did fully carry out that compact. And we're not the only country who believes somehow, has taken a statement that we support this social compact. We were one of the signers of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that the UN pulled together in 1948, which basically declares every citizen of the world has right to quality education, a whole list of freedoms that I think most of us in this country take for granted, and they talked about economic stuff that you could not be forced, you could not be forced to live in slavery. You had a right to free choice and things like this, and that you deserved an adequate shelter for your family. You deserved adequate housing and health care. But again, while some other countries have lived up to this, we've never lived up to it. And since the 1960s. Medicare, again, was to take care of health care for the elderly, but there are very few seniors who don't believe it's necessary to buy the Medicare supplements. And even that, in a state like Minnesota, does not cover prescription drugs, which many can't afford. And the social compact, while we've never lived up to it, I think if you just try sometime at your workplace or down your neighborhood, take an informal poll of 10 people. I'd care to bet you probably get a normal group of people, 80% would say, yes, I believe that somebody who's working 40 hours a week should be able to pay their bills, should be able to get enough of a wage that they don't have to do without health care, housing, etc. And while there is widespread public support, 80% is a landslide in politics. The political system isn't responsive to that, and I don't think it's going to be responsive to that. So if we're a caring, humane society, not the Ebenezer Scrooge type where, well, if aren't there enough workhouses for the poor? If, well, they'd rather die than be there. Well, let them die and kill off the surplus population. If we're not an Ebenezer Scrooge society, but a humane, caring one, and we don't believe it's acceptable for people to go homeless and hungry, and we think people should put in their fair share of work, which would mean we consider as a society, maybe that changes over the years, but 40 hours a week, how do we address the problem? I see two ways. Maybe others see others, but the two I see is one, either ensure that all workers ensure a human wage, a livable wage, however you want to phrase it, a wage, a minimum wage, a wage that's sufficient to support themselves. Or as an alternative or supplement, you could merge the two, that government or somebody is going to subsidize necessities, provide adequate food, childcare for people who need to work and have kids they have to take care of, housing, healthcare. And that's sort of what's happened in the past 70 years. At the same time, government stepped in and provided some of these things through AFDC and now other replacements for that, through food stamps, through medical assistance, etc. Government's done some of that, and charitable organizations have done some of that, including churches. But again, it's never been sufficient. They've never met all the needs. And that's even in the late years of the 90s when government's doing some of it, and charities and people have money, and charities we have to say they were getting more support. People were doing well and they were getting a lot of donations. But even in the best of times, we had more homeless people in the late 90s by a long shot, and more uninsured people in the 90s by a long shot than we had 30 years earlier. But again, whether you're talking government or charities or a combination of both, which, as I said, even the combination hasn't done that, you either, if you believe somebody who's working deserves basic necessities, you either have to make sure they get enough pay or you have to subsidize it somehow. There may be third options I can't think about. Well, what about other ways of addressing the broader problem? The most common one I hear, and it's the one that's usually used by people who say we're doing enough, but if we want to help people, we've got to educate them better, train them better. And that's a great idea. If you get better training, you can get a better paying job and a better career. It's a good thing to do, and I think I and you and every one of us would advise some young person who's struggling to get on what they should do. We advise them, get more education, learn a career, get a good job. And that's great on a microeconomic level. For you're having trouble, I'll advise that to you. It's not always feasible. I mean, if you're trying to support a family and you can't afford to go back to school, and your employer that paid a good wage has laid you off, and now you're struggling to pay the bills, you don't necessarily have a chance to go back and learn, get the degree or skill you need in order to get a better job. But even if it is feasible, that doesn't solve the problem. Because, and again, turn back to Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dime, this country, any society, is going to still have fast food joints that need clerks, retail stores that need cashiers. They're going to have the people who pick up our garbage and who clean motel rooms. There are going to be a lot of those jobs, farm people who pick farm products, farm produce, farm workers. We're going to need a lot of people who fill what we call low skill. Some of them require significant skills, but low skill, low wage jobs. And while you can tell everybody, if we did a perfect job of educating people and made sure everybody got a great college, four-year college education in this country, some of the people are still going to be working in the fast food joints. Some of the people are still going to be cleaning motel rooms. some of the people are still going to be doing the low-skill and currently low-wage jobs. And basically what you end up doing by educating everybody very well then is you have a lot of people who, like Barbara Ehrenreich, can write about how she went into these jobs feeling she was way overqualified and trying to want to hide that when she was applying for the jobs and finding out that she didn't feel overqualified for any of them. But you'd have it's a good advice to teach people, and we want people to get a good education. We want them to move up the career ladder. But the bottom line is, that's not an acceptable way to say, we're going to take care of the working poor by educating everybody, because somebody is still going to be filling in those entry-level jobs and maybe filling it in for their entire life. So let's go back to the two options I'm suggesting we ought to take a serious look at. The second option of subsidizing necessities because people aren't making enough money. Well, we've been trying that, as I said, and it's certainly a necessary thing to do if you're not going to meet the first option of paying an adequate wage. You're going to be required to subsidize if you want people to not do without. The other point about it is that some people, for one reason or another, usually some limitation, whether it's a disability or what, are not simply not able to find a job, hold down a job. And while we should be working to help them with that, I think, and we made a lot of bad assumptions in the past, especially about physical disabilities, because we can see that. Oh, a poor blind person, we should have sympathy for them. And if you know people who are blind, that's the last thing they want. They want to be a human being who can contribute to society as well. They don't want pity, they want help in being self-sufficient. But nevertheless, there are always going to be some people because of age or infirmity or disability, mental or physical, they're going to be unable to hold down a job. And so there's always a need for subsidizing some. But other points about the current system is I think it's a political reality that we can all agree to, is that there's growing opposition to what we would call welfare. And most states, when they think of welfare, they think of the single parent, single mother with three kids and three more on the way, who's milking the system for everything they can, who's probably spent her entire life on welfare, which with time limits, I think percentage-wise, a small number, who may have lived that way, they're not doing that anymore. And frankly, people never would have believed that probably the biggest social welfare was nursing home care for the elderly in the last few decades. Far and away, medical assistance absorbs state and federal budgets for welfare, and predominantly that's long-term care. But they think of some lazy person, even if they're working, lazy person who's taking money from them. And so there is a fact of life in American politics, is there's strong and growing opposition to government subsidies to low-income people for whatever reason. They subsidize business, but not individuals. And so as budgets go through tight times, governments cut back on the amount they subsidize. And the other argument I make about this, the other criticism I make about trying to do things through subsidizing a low-income worker, is that I don't think it's an ideal way to do it. It is, if you give somebody something, they grow dependent upon it, and it's also very hard to determine who deserves this and how much they do and how do you, government's been struggling that for many years in the US and European countries. It's not the best way to do it. You're gonna need to provide some basic needs, subsidize them where others can't take care of themselves, but relying on that to help low-wage workers get by is not a great idea. And certainly, it's a massive subsidy of business. I spend a lot of time being critical and fighting against what I would call government subsidies of private business. I just don't think that's the role of government to do that. But the biggest single subsidy I would argue we give to business across the board is government subsidizes low-wage jobs. Because people with low-wage jobs that can't afford housing, that's why we have affordable housing programs. That's why we have affordable child care, affordable health care programs. And that is a major subsidy that we provide to businesses that don't pay enough for that. What about churches, other nonprofit groups providing charity to meet needs. Well, that's important. It's helpful, I would argue, around the fringes. I saw a poster somebody put up in the 1980s when welfare cuts began to take effect. It said in 1933, government took the responsibility for helping the poor away from the churches and the nonprofits. In 1982 or whatever, it gave it back. And I remember in the early in the Reagan years, they said, well, if every church would just take, I don't know what they calculated, for welfare recipient families, low-income families, if every congregation would take, I think it was eight families, to take care of the problem. If you come for worship in a major church of several thousand members, a mega church, taking care of eight families might be a doable project, but if you're a small town in western North Dakota with a three-point parish and 50 people in there, there's no way in the world that they can do their share of the eight families who you take care of that way. And government, private, and church-related giving has never been able to do that, and frankly, it's not the best way to provide somebody something where we're going to give you money for an apartment or we're going to give you money for food. It's not an ideal way to do it, and churches or nonprofits never did. They can help fill in the gaps, but increasingly they're being pushed to do things they can't possibly do. And while that's an important role of the churches, I think most people would argue that it's not the sole role of the churches. And churches have lots of other things to do, and most of them are struggling to meet budgets anyhow. So we turn to the other option, which I'd like to spell out a way of looking at it before opening it up for discussion. And that is the idea of, what if we were to look at wages that were sometimes called livable wages or human wages? Some cities around the country have passed livable wage ordinances in which any business in their city that gets some sort of subsidy for redevelopment or whatever is required to pay a living wage. I think the three largest cities in Minnesota all have it. St. Paul has one such ordinance. I think it's like $8 an hour or something is a livable wage, which Barbara Ehrenreich and many millions of people trying to make it on $8 an hour would challenge, but I think it was $8 or $9 an hour in St. Paul, and then the former Dayton Hudson department store downtown needed some redevelopment thing. Well, we have to waive that requirement because they won't want to do it even with the subsidy then. So even where there's been one, it's only been for businesses asking for a direct grant from government, and even then it's often waived, and even then what's a living wage is not a precise thing. Well, you could deal with the minimum wage. That's the purpose of the minimum wage. The value of it has gone way down in recent years, and the way we measure inflation, well, government spending is going up faster than inflation, partly because the way we measure inflation, we take an average of goods. And my little laptop here, to get a computer that did that same quantity of processing ability 30 years ago, didn't cost half as much, it would have cost 10,000 times as much. You probably couldn't buy a computer that did that, even if you had a whole room full of computing equipment. It wouldn't do that 30 years ago. It would have cost 10,000 times as much. So there's been some deflation in parts of the economy. Technology, 10,000-fold deflation. Farmers can have grown in efficiency to the point they can produce 10 times, 100 times what they could have a century ago. School teachers, they're not getting any better. They still have classrooms of 20 to 30 kids. You want to double their productivity, double their class size. Quadruple it if you want to. Maybe you can't do that in certain fields. A psychologist meeting with a patient for a half hour appointment to make them more productive, have them talk twice as fast. So certain parts of the economy, you look at the cost of living, certain things are going to go up faster than others. And on average, government tends to deal with the things like the teachers and the psychologists who are dealing with people with chemical dependency. They're dealing with things that are very much one-on-one, and healthcare. And if you think the overall inflation, we do at least keep separate track of healthcare inflation in this country, and it grows a lot faster than the average cost. And so government spending is going up faster than inflation. And the real persons, the person who's living on $8 an hour or trying to do so, yeah, they can, if you figure an average of things including new technologies, hey, you think that if they have inflationary pay increases, minimum wage hasn't kept up, as I said, they could keep buying the same amount of computers they buy, but if they don't buy computers, maybe if they're trying to pay for health care, they're sinking further down. And so you could increase the minimum wage little bit by little bit, but I pointed out in this discussion about this earlier today about how in Minnesota every couple of years, every 3 or 4 years, we raise the minimum wage, boldly stepping forward with 50 cents an hour or so, and then we wait a few more years and inflation robs him another dollar, and then we raise it another 30 or 50 cents. And then, so we're slowly going backwards on making it affordable. What if we were to take the concept of a livable wage and say that, and in the Twin Cities that might be $13 an hour, in rural Minnesota it might be $10 an hour, in some parts of Montana maybe it'd be $7 an hour, depending on cost of housing and everything else. What if we were to try and calculate a fair wage and give employers an option, because I don't think politically or any other way you could sell the idea of somebody who's just starting up a small business right now paying a livable wage, it would be a major shakeup of the economy. But if every employer was required to either pay a livable wage or pay a separate poverty wage tax, in effect, that could be used then to help fill in the gaps, we might get there. Why couldn't we do this? Well, that's a radical notion. I mean, that's not in the political charts. The concept of people earning a living wage, I think, is something that, again, take that poll of your neighbors. How many people think that somebody who is working full-time should have enough for to meet basic necessities? It is a 7 or 8 or 8.5 to out of 10 people are going to say, I think that's a fair goal, that's what we should have. But the political system talking about that, that's a radical notion. Well, if you really want to get back to what's reasonable, responsible, what's acceptable, the political system is what's radical and radically out of touch with what it would be on the end. And I think public support, if you tell them, look, if we don't think people should be hungry and homeless, especially when they're working, if you believe that's the case, then who's going to make up the difference? The employer paying a decent wage in the economy, or the taxpayer, which does it now, or poorly does it, but tries to do it now through government subsidies? And one of the big objections, of course, you're going to hear to this is that any time you raise the minimum wage by a quarter an hour, we hear from the Chamber of Commerce, at least in Minnesota, and I think this is true in every state, you hear that this is going to drive inflation upward. Well, CEO and top executive salary in the past 2 decades, the same time as this, have gone up many, many, many times faster than inflation. How come that's never used as an argument against that hey, that's going to drive inflation? And you look at the wage gap differential between rich and poor, it grows phenomenally, and we don't do much about it. So my thought on how we ought to be pursuing this is to give employers a choice. You have to pay minimum wage. It's federal law, if not state law, as well. But you have a choice. You're going to pay what we calculate to be a livable wage, and it's not going to make you rich. Again, there's the way minimum wage was supposed to take care of. It's not going to make you rich. You're not going to be driving a fancy car. You're not going to have all the fancy gadgets. You're not going to be going on nice vacations. You may not be going on any vacation. During our last fight on minimum wage, some waitress talked about, she wrote a really nice poem, it's kind of like Barbara Ehrenreich, a great author kind of thing, but she's working in a low-wage job, and she says, when my boss comes in and says he can't afford a minimum wage, I understand and I sympathize with him. It means that he might be have one less week to spend in his timeshare condo. And it means I might not be able to take my son out for an ice cream cone once a month. And it's a very nice thing. It means he might be able to not exchange his luxury car every year. It means I might not be able to get a new alternator for my car that doesn't run anymore. But the concept of the employer having a choice of paying beyond the minimum wage or paying a tax to help pay for these things that government is currently subsidizing, I think makes some sense. This is not something that, hey, 2 years from now, 4 years from now, we're all going to be talking about how this happened and this is a great thing. But I think we have to start around the country opening the debate up. Is it a fair concept? Is there a social compact here that you work hard, you're gonna be able to at least make ends meet? Or are we at the point where we say, we as a society don't have the money to do that? And I don't find it acceptable as a citizen. I don't believe that's realistic economics. And I don't think it's a humane way to treat other people. So I would like to make the proposal that instead of saying, well, we're going to try somehow to ask nonprofits and others to make up the growing gap as government fails out, as wages continue to fall relative to cost of living, that we ought to be setting a new way, not by nickel and diming up the minimum wage, but by setting up a new standard that we expect employers to do. And as I see, it's about 6:30 now. We have to quit right at 7 because Vespers is early tonight. But I want to open it up to discussion. Feel free to challenge things I'm saying here too, or add to things or take away things, whatever you want. Andrew.
This may be pitching you a fastball down the middle, John, but we're living with a governor in Minnesota that is not alone in that simplistic pledge of no new taxes. Can you comment on the climate of our culture right now that is attracted to that mantra?
Yeah, I'd be happy to comment. First, we'd like to say that really, this should be something a governor like ours should love. It takes the responsibility of subsidizing people's housing and healthcare and food and everything else away from government and restores it to the private sector. I don't think he'll buy that. I'm telling you that it does reduce the cost of government. If business pays a living wage for a worker, and again, I think they should, then it would reduce their obligation. In answer to your question, the political climate of the self-centeredness, it's been sold and hyped by many people who have a lot of access to the airwaves, either because of dollars spent for advertising or because they own the airwaves, in terms of persuading us that the system is there. Plus, I'd argue there's one side of the political spectrum, and I don't see a spectrum as a line, but sort of a big mass where people are here and here and all over the place. But there's been a very, very clear and consistent voice for Barry Goldwater may have been the founder of it. I don't know that Barry Goldwater would like what's happening these days, but the concept that government is bad, taxes are bad, and anything should be done by individuals whenever possible instead of government. And the concept that some things are better as a common good is very weak these days. We talked about common good last week, but it's very weak. And the idea that we might save money by doing it, I think there's an intellectual understanding of it, but it's one that's too complicated for people to sell. We had our new governor had a breakfast meeting with Senate committee chairs a few months ago, and a discussion, and it was a nice, lively discussion, and I had one pressing question, which I asked him, and I told him that in budget cuts that were coming through because of his decision for no taxes, I said, you know, I wasn't so concerned that our prisons wouldn't be able to function, because you have to fund that. You have to fund certain basic things, the state patrol, maybe lay off a few more state troopers, but basically those things are going to survive. The thing I was concerned about was after school programs for troubled kids, chemical dependency programs for troubled kids, and so on. The prevention programs are the first things to go, because we either extras and we can't afford them. And I told him, you know, there are lots of things. I mentioned specifically chemical dependency, where the dollar spent now saves a lot in the long run. And he interrupted me to say that he understood my concern. I told him it wasn't a concern, but he understood my concern, and he said, I know there are many times I hear that $1 spent now saves $4 or more in the long run. He said, I understand that. He said, but John, you've got to understand that we don't have the $1. So I interrupted him and told him, you know, I think that's a heck of a poor long-term planning strategy. If I have $1 now, where in the world are we going to get $4 in the future? But his response was very much, he understands. People can understand that. Pete Wilson, who is not a raging radical leftist, when he was governor of California, backed and funded, I believe, a study on chemical dependency, which it said every dollar you spend, the taxpayers spend on chemical dependency. Every dollar, and that's a minority of them nowadays, but every dollar the taxpayers spend on chemical dependency treatment saves taxpayers $7. And this was in the 4 year, 91 to 94 time frame, saves taxpayers $7 and largely reduce health care, crime, and education costs. $7. That's not 17 or 70 or 700% rate of return. That's a good investment. And they, even for somebody who's very me-centered, I want to get the best for myself, I picture people like politicians who are in that mode who say, well, I don't want government doing some of these things, but you know, if we can get a good payback like that, that's good for me. And so even if you're looking at it from a self-centered point of view, I picture that being the case, but you're right, the political climate is very much into government is evil, to the point that we have former Republican governors of Minnesota saying this is wrong. This is absolutely wrong, and they wouldn't support this. I think you have a lot of commentators around the country, a lot of ordinary citizens saying, well, I wanted some changes, but this isn't what I wanted. But that's clearly the predominant political mood, Minnesota, the U.S. government, California, most places. Over, I'll try and register.
Well, I was just going to say, it's an interesting bill of goods that's been sold, basically by the people who benefit the most. People who say less government and less taxes, the ones who are benefiting the most are the most wealthy. Mm-hmm. And we're in a country where that gap is...
It's growing, they've got more
clout. It's growing, and they have more clout. But, you know, you think in a democracy where you can draw the line wherever you want, at the top 10%, the top 5%, you'd think you'd have, I don't know, 80, 90% of the voting populace that was saying, you know, if we're really going to benefit me, let's say no taxes up until, you know, I can pick a number, 50, 60,000. And for really high-end, you know, that top 10, 15%, let's redistribute the wealth. You know, let's have a inheritance tax. There's no reason that this, you know, this family's child should go on and live a lifestyle just because of birth. And so I guess I...
You wonder why this happens?
Well, I think it happens because everybody thinks, you know, someday I'm going to be the one paying the taxes, but that's not true for 80, 90, 95% of the population.
You are right that that's one of the factors why people do often envision that somehow they're going to be wealthy. The other part, and I'd argue the biggest single reason for it, is who funds political campaigns, who gets people elected.
He's at the trough.
When in June, Bush could in two nights raise, I think it was $8 million. That's phenomenal amounts of money coming in, day after day after day. And his opponents, who are raising a fraction of what he's raising, still where they're getting most of them are getting most of their money from the big donors. And McCain-Feingold, which is a good step forward in one way, is a big step backwards in the sense it doubled the hard money you could give. And when you see who not only funds politicians, who their friends are, one congressman from South Carolina, now defeated, was selected in mid-90s, and national news covered his quote once because it was so interesting. He said he considered himself to be lower middle income, and reporters said, well, you know, you just retired from this other thing, and your disclosure says you get, $60,000 in pension from that a year. and you're making 130-some thousand as a U.S. congressman, you're making 190,000 a year. Yeah, that's lower middle class. Well, where's middle class? Somewhere around 200,000 to 250,000. You know, I wonder what rich is for him. But that's the reality. I mean, if you take a poll of the public, I'll bet you 97% think they're middle class. All but the poorest of the poor think they are middle class, and all but the richest of the rich. I think people in the top 1%, some of them think they're middle class. Upper middle, maybe, but they think they're
Would you fill out your notion of the tax that you're suggesting businesses could pay in lieu of paying a livable wage?
Sure. I have not, this is not a proposal ready for legislation. This is an idea that I think deserves a procedure, but I do think that at the beginning, I think in terms of implementing something like this, you'd have to start out with, if you were to say, hey, well, for every employee you're paying less than this, you're going to pay this much per hour for that. You couldn't do it that way. I think what you'd have to start doing is moving up there in a tax that eventually will get it so that employers are paying the equivalent of what they need to pay to get that minimum. And if they say that's too hard, we can structure the economy any way we want. Why do we determine that athletes are worth this much and people who care for our elderly are worth $6 an hour? We can make those determinations as a society, but it's not a smooth transition. I would assume some sort of whether it's a per capita tax on employers or whatever, I think you'd have to figure out a way to, you'd have to raise a significant amount of money. And if the employers say, look, you know, we understand that some businesses do this, I could picture the Chamber of Commerce type saying, well, maybe what we should do, if they knew this was coming, they'd say maybe all employers should pay a little bit of a tax on this to help fill out the gaps, to subsidize the gap. And I would not argue overnight that expecting McDonald's to pay $13 an hour would happen. And in acknowledging that the people who say that this would drive inflation, yeah, if McDonald's paid their employees twice as much, cost of their hamburgers and stuff would go up. But on average, basically what it's gonna mean is maybe people on top end are getting less of an edge on people below them. In line with the previous comment, I fail to see how more people aren't more outraged when a major airline will lay off thousands of employees and demand salary cutbacks and then give their executives $1 million bonus. And it happens. And I mean, there's the political ability to do that, the political ability to change it, but I don't have a specific tax.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I guess, if there was some kind of notion of an incentive for a business, if they chose not to, or perhaps they would choose not to pay a livable wage because they know they could pay this tax, which they think might save them money.
Right.
Was there that sort of
notion? That's why eventually you have to have the tax be high enough to cover the difference. A lot of employers decide, I mean, Henry Ford, who was not a raging reformer, when he decided to pay his auto workers $5 a day, one of the arguments he gave was, well, then they will be able to afford more of these cars I want to sell. There's something to that in a macroeconomic sense that people at the bottom, if they can afford some things, they may be able to do that. But and obviously many employers pay more than they have to anyhow. Sometimes because that's what the market determines, sometimes because that's what they feel appropriate. I know a small business woman in a nearby community who's getting active in politics and owned a heating and cooling firm, and she said, yeah, we provide our, it's non-union firm, they bought it up, she and her husband bought it up 10 years ago, and they significantly increased their wages, they provided health benefits, because they thought their employees deserved it. They're making ends meet. They both work very hard, but they're making ends meet, and they're proud of their business, and I think their employees serve them well. So it's not just that, but I think you're right. A lot of employers will have their accountants calculate, is it cheaper to pay the tax? But that's why you have to move the tax to be high enough eventually to do it.
Thank you.
over here than over there?
Europe, it's believed, I think, that Europe has less job growth than we do because of some of the burdens, some of the tax situation is on their wages. If would we see some of that come over here if we instituted something like that? Would we see less dynamic, you know, economy, less job growth?
One of the arguments, I mean, I would say there are a thousand reasons why our economy in some ways is better than European ones, and some reasons why there's a whole range of things. The argument that the people who disagree most with me on would say that, that, you know, hey, people need incentive, they'll work harder. Well, Michael Eisner at Disney doesn't work harder than he does if you cut his pay by $2,000 an hour. he's not going to work less hard. Matter of fact, you can make the argument he's going to have to work harder so he can make more money. But the concept that somebody is going to work, somebody is going to, because they can't profit as much because of this, you know, if you shift the entire economy over a period of time to a model like this, I don't see a reason why it would be less productive. I think we could make our economy more productive with things if we had like a national health insurance system, because every one of our employers with our employer-based health system, in effect, we put a tariff on our auto exports, which is why we don't have many of them, because they say 10% of the cost of American car goes into the automaker and auto suppliers' healthcare benefits when Japan and Europe usually paid for out of a separate system. But I would not argue that the overall, I mean, there's so many thousands of other factors into what goes into making a country productive and more productivity. I think the single thing I would do if I wanted to increase our country's productivity would be make sure we continue to have a well-educated, well-trained population. If there was one thing I think business could appreciate best, it's that. And I think a lot of our communities, Minnesota's cut back on education so far, I think the benefits we've had are our economy's grown far faster than any other northern state around us. Our population's grown as a result. We used to invest very heavily in education. Now we're around the middle. And I think 20 years from now, we won't be ahead the way we were the last 20 years because of that. But saying that the overall job growth in Europe has been slower because of they do more of this. And frankly, Europe does have a lot of European, northern European countries. Norway has some of the most generous benefits. And again, when you're doing it through paying employees more, I think you can make the argument if CEOs work harder for more money, workers work harder for more money. Certainly if people are able to not worry about their bills and where they're going to go home to sleep at night, I think they work harder. I'd argue it's a better thing for job creation to have it funded this way than to have over subsidies of government. But there are plenty of arguments people prove of tax cuts create more jobs and more government money. If under that argument, you can always argue, why don't we just eliminate taxes? We'll get all the more money ever. There's a limit. There's a little connection, but I would argue there are bigger factors on the other side.
What role do you think the globalization of the economy has in all this? It continues at a pretty fast rate, and is that a current that we're eventually not going to be able to swim against, or is that, you know, how does that work into it in your thinking?
Well, one of the issues in the globalization debate of quote fair trade versus quote free trade is the fact that that paper company employees in Minnesota, whether at $18, $19 an hour or $12 an hour, competing with somebody earning $2 an hour overseas, there's very definitely that's been driving down certain wages of certain things. But, and it's a hard thing to compete. We are losing. Most Minnesota over the 90s actually gained some manufacturing jobs, but the last few years we, like the rest of the country, have been losing. And that's a change. We are growing more towards a service economy, something we've got to recognize. and that does drive down wages. Trade has brought down wages in poor countries and wages in our countries, I would argue, the way it's done. But nevertheless, the lowest wage jobs here still are not in manufacturing, where they're losing them to overseas. It tends to be in things that aren't that mobile. A Burger King in my home city of Roseville is not going to move to Chicago because wages might be lower, or Montana, because wages might be lower there.
But they can pay those low wages because there isn't the competition for those people's time, you know, in manufacturing.
Right. Well, there's a certain point, but I mean, manufacturing wages under the true, many of our things don't, the market is not a perfect system. And under that thing, then, as manufacturing jobs are going away, in order to keep them, the drive should be driving down the, as the jobs get more scarce, it should be driving down wages, and it's not happening that way. So I would argue that globalization in the big picture is bringing down wages for working people here, working people in Mexico or China or wherever, not bringing them up, as argued by supporters of it, but also that while that's a major factor and it probably does depress the wages, that nevertheless, and that may be an unstoppable force, I don't know, but that's again one of many factors. Otherwise, you'd be having manufacturing jobs being as low as service jobs, which I think there's some choices we make as a society how we do it. And one of it was sexist. Women's job, taking care of little kids, child care, taking care of parents and older people, a human service type of thing was women's work, and they weren't breadwinners, so we could pay them less. Minnesota 20 years ago did a study on pay equity between men and women and found in state government in every field, if you calculated jobs by the skills required, the training required, the judgment skills required, a whole range of things, those studies where they say women get paid an average of 59 cents an hour or 67 cents an hour for what a man does, the same thing. They found a whole lot of that in state government, and they shifted, enacted a pay equity thing that tried to shift that balance. And over time, that does change the way a society pays for people, but it's one factor. Well,
John, could you comment on the extent to which the reduction in those that are represented by unions plays into this? Because at some level, the people that you're referring to that we're concerned about have no economic power. And I think with unions as well, it brought people into the political system. And so these are also people that are not participating in the political system. And then my own editorial is, I think our party, the Democratic Party, I think at times can be faulted. It's great for us to be friends of organized labor, and I think we have been by and large. But those that are left out are a lot of people that are not represented by organized labor, and I think some of the issues you're talking about really haven't been at the forefront of the political agenda because the upside politically hasn't been there to the extent that it is when we're talking about those with more political and economic clout, that being the unions.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that the people, the working poor, are the least represented in the political system. They don't have time to go to the Capitol and lobby for themselves. They're trying to pay the bills. Certain labor unions are very much concerned about the poor. Others are not so concerned. I remember meeting with one union, a Teamsters union, I'll say, because it was Teamsters. I was talking about universal health care. Well, we don't care about universal health care. Our employees have health care. And I told him that it was absolutely outrageous what he was saying. And having said that, the labor unions have argued in favor of things like minimum wage when most of their employees are way above that. But yes, the labor movement in ideal setting is concerned about the poor, and in many cases truly is. Other cases, it becomes self-serving like any institution often does. And it would behoove people to, I always argue that one of the reasons for taking money out of politics is so people respond to the need, not so they respond to who's got the pressure there. And labor, like business, I I think that people should be judging ideas on their merits, not who's got the money to contribute to the political process. We have time since the bell rang. We actually have three more. We have six minutes to seven, but we got to leave a couple minutes early for Vespers. So maybe two more questions, comments, concerns.
How could the faith-based system help us in Minnesota problem?
I was the church groups, Congregation of Concern for Children, groups, organizations such as that, there's a Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy, they've become more active, especially the Catholic social justice movement has become much more active. 2 years ago, I got good stack of yellow postcards saying, I care about affordable housing for the poor, and I volunteer in the homeless shelter, I see this, I see that. Please help. Be concerned about this. And that was a new one, because in recent years, boy, 90% of the letter writing campaigns and the contact your legislator things have been either the cut my taxes or don't do this for somebody else kind of thing. It's very seldom, this isn't for me, this is for somebody else. And faith-based organizations, because certainly our Lutheran tradition and Christian tradition talks very heavily about concern for our neighbors and need. And they can and should be more vocal, and I think a lot of legislators were surprised. Our previous governor once, when he was saying, well, you guys want your rebate, you want your tax cuts and rebates, right? And he told this Joint Religious Legislative Coalition on their day at the Hill, they had 300 people there in his office, you want, you know, I mean, I know you want all this stuff, but you guys want your tax cuts too, don't you? And they all said, no, and the governor kind of, what am I supposed to say to these people? They're not. Any one last?
Would you put the Move On website on the board for people?
I could if you keep it, it's kind of dark. You can tell them.
I don't. My sister here. Yeah. MoveOn.org. You guys, if you all get on something like that, you have no idea what it does in Washington, D.C. It's making a difference. Legislators.
There are many political groups that you can contact, whether your concern is economic justice or environment or whatever. There are many ways you can get involved, and frankly, talking with elected officials is worth doing, and being persistent with them, not mean, but persistent. Please, I care about this. Why can't we? Do you really think it's okay? Ask. I feel we need more people to ask our governor. Is it okay that disabled children can't afford medical care because we're going to cut the system to pieces? I think people should ask those questions and be persistent. Not mean, but say, how do you think this is okay? You don't have to say, how do you sleep at night about this? Do you believe this is okay? And you believe that what's happening is not dismantling that. But I think those, it's very important that we all do pay attention to the system and work hard to do it. And with that, it's about 1 minute, 2 minutes to seven. So thank you.